Happy New Year? Happy New Year? Yeah, just checking. Very good. My name's Michael. If we haven't met, let me add my welcome. It's nice to see people combined, especially as we know many up the coast and doing different things. I hope you had a great night last night. I'm not sure if you made the fireworks or did different things. We've got a bit of a family tradition around New Year's where we do the year after next, right? So a lot of it's 2017. It usually takes me a month till I start signing that right on bits of paper. You like that? To write 2017 instead of 16. And some of you I know have got your head around the age that you're going to be turning this year or that your kids are going to be turning. But try this. Think of your oldest child, if you've got a child here, or think of your own age, and think, what age are you looking at now for the year after next? So it's one thing for us to have a son that's going into year 10. That's already messing with our head. But when I say to Deborah, and by the way, the year after next, he'll be doing his HSC. It's kind of like that, okay? So New Year's is funny like that, isn't it? It's a time when we do think, where is life up to? You know, where have we come from? Where are we heading? And it's always that time of year too where people put out, this is the future. This is what it's going to look like. Or this is what 2016 is. You know, and you get the list of, you know, it's the year of celebrity death. Or, you know, here are the albums of 2016 that you should have heard or the books you should have read. Have you noticed the one with the dictionaries? Oxford English Dictionary came out with the word of the year. In fact, the international word of the year. Anyone know what it was? Post-truth, right? Oxford English Dictionary says the international word of the year that captures the spirit of our age is post-truth. Now, you might have already spotted a problem with that. Have you spotted the problem with it? It's two words. Right? But that's okay. We're post-truth. You know, two words can be one word. Post-truth came up a lot this year. And they noticed it enough to say, here is a word which people are starting to use to describe the times that we're in. And it comes up in politics all the time. So if you've ever listened to a politician getting interviewed and you get frustrated because the interviewer will ask a question and the question will say something about, you know, how come the tax rate is here? And then they'll answer something very different. So rather than talk about the facts which have been brought up, they respond with the words that they wanted to say all along, the prepared talking points, the thing that the PR people have given them. Here's the way to spin the truth. Right? And instead of talking about truth and facts and stuff like that, instead we talk about very emotional, grabbing kind of words that can help win arguments. Arguments that don't depend on truth anymore because we're post-truth. Truth is a secondary thing. Instead we make emotional kind of appeals. Not just in politics. You see this coming up all the time with different media. But you see it with people, talking about God as well. We took holidays before Christmas this year, drove to the Gold Coast and back, right? Tarago full of children. That was fun. And at one point we're listening to talkback radio and James Valentine was on. Somehow was going up the coast and, he said, look, it's the week of Christmas. And he feels like a lot of the time the message about Jesus just gets swamped by all the other stuff that gets added on. All the kind of tinsel was how he described it. You know, fun stuff, but stuff that didn't belong in the original Christmas. And so he said, why don't we give the Christians a fair go and give them 20 minutes or so to talk about why Christmas matters and what Christmas is all about. He said, I'm not religious myself. You know, I'm not a Christian, but I'm not against it either. He said, but I mostly just don't know what I believe and I want to know. And so why don't we give them a chance, just some free air, not to talk about other stuff, but just to talk about what Christmas is really all about. And he brought in, four Christians, to kick that out around. And I thought, firstly, isn't that remarkable? that he's honest in that kind of way, and also that he's open to doing that, and what a wonderful opportunity it was. Well, the four Christians came on, and let me tell you, some of them were a bit confused, because when James Valentine said, well, can we talk about some of the stuff like virgin birth? Do we need to believe that Jesus was, you know, born in the flesh? Do we need to believe in that, say? And you could hear the dead air as they thought, oh, here's a dangerous question. And a couple of them kind of came back and said, look, I don't think that's so much what Christmas is all about. We don't want to talk so much about doctrine and what it is that people might believe or not believe. What really counts is that Jesus is an inspiration for us now in the way that we live, in the way that we care for the poor and the oppressed and the alien and the exile, that he came into this world to show us those things, right? And so they're given a question, do you believe in Jesus coming in the flesh, you know, born of a virgin? And they wouldn't answer. Now, why was that? Well, I reckon they were a bit embarrassed and maybe caught on the spot. Maybe they believed it, maybe they didn't. We didn't find out. But they didn't want to confess it publicly because they realized it would sound silly. Talk of Jesus coming in the flesh like that sounds a bit silly. Why don't we talk about something which we know people will like? So let's talk about how Jesus is an inspiration, right? And understandably, James Valentine's response was, that's fantastic, because that's what I believe too. I find him inspiring, and I find other leaders inspiring, like Gandhi and different people. And what really counts is the way that we care for others. So Christmas is about generosity, and it's about not being selfish, and it's, you know, and so agreement was found, and yet something very precious there seemed to have been lost. And all because there was a different kind of take on truth. All because it was a post-truth kind of conversation. Now, if they'd opened 2 John, it would have been a very different conversation. I wonder if we could bring the text of 2 John up. Can we do that? And just, let's just leave that up, and as we work through, if you can flip the next screen when we need to. So 2 John, John introduces himself as the elder, but also as the great lover of truth. He describes himself as the elder because, anyone think of the reason? He's old. That's right. Exactly, Leslie. And when he was a young man, he'd walked around with Jesus. He was the beloved disciple of Jesus, and all the Gospels name him and mention him, and John's Gospel was written by him. Okay, so you've got John's Gospel, you've got 1, 2, and 3 John, written by John as letters to the churches, and also the book of Revelation, which is also known as the Apocalypse of St. John, right, the last book in the Bible. So John, by the time he's writing the letters and by the time he's writing Revelation, is certainly an old man. We know that as an old man, as he writes Revelation, he's on the island of Patmos off the coast of modern-day Turkey. And looking back over a long life of following Jesus and telling others of him and seeing many of his other disciples be killed for the same faith, right? And so he writes as the elder to the dear lady and to her children. Anyone got an idea who the dear lady might be? I don't think it's a person. I think he's actually describing the church, right? I think it's just the way to describe the church, that she's a lady, and that the children are spiritual children. They're Christians. And the children, so down to the very last verse, the children of your chosen sister send their greetings. He's speaking there of another church. That's just the way he speaks. But he introduces himself as the one who's the great lover of truth. Have a look there at verse 1. To the chosen lady and her children, whom I love, how does he love them? In the truth. Not only I, but also all who know the truth. So he loves them in the truth, and he knows that other people who are in the truth are going to love them as well. Why? Verse 2. Because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. So within 2 verses, he's got truth in 3 times, right? Here is a guy who loves truth and says it is characteristic of the way he understands himself and his relationship to them and their relationship to others. And if the church is to be the church, and if Christians are to be Christians, they have to be characterized by truth. Right? Is that you? It's hard living in a post-truth world to say, I'm the kind of person who takes a stand for truth. We're not all put on the spot on the radio and asked the questions, but we know that moment in conversations, don't we, where they say, do you believe that? Is that you? If you're not someone yet who is a Christian and you're looking at this, do you realize that you're being asked to sign up to certain kind of truths? That this is a question which will put you out of step with the culture around? What is the truth? Well, I think he tells us that that truth which is going to live in us and be with us forever, look at it described in verse 3. Grace, mercy and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love. That's the true message which he'd been telling them from the beginning. That if you've got Jesus, you've got grace from God, God's kindness to you. You've got mercy. You've been forgiven by God. You've got peace with God. To have Jesus is to have these things. And you can be 100% confident in them. This is not, oh, I think it might be something to do with this, or I'm not sure, I have my doubts. This is solid, certain conviction, right? What is certain in life? What is certain in life? You ask an Australian, what's certain in life? What's the answer that you get? Taxes and death. That's right. I was expecting death and taxes. That's exactly what was said. Because we know that those things are certain, right? The Christian adds to that and says, this truth about Jesus is just as certain, even more certain than death and taxes. Right? It's of that kind of order. It's not a fudging around the edges, oh, I think it might be this, or possibly it could mean that. It's that if you have Jesus, you have grace, you have mercy, you have peace. Do you know truth like that? Right? If Jesus has come in the flesh, then we can know God. If he has not, we cannot. If Jesus is risen from the dead bodily, then we may also. If he has not, we cannot. If Jesus says he's returning, he will. These certainties about who Jesus is and what he has done are things which we're being told to hold on to as certainly as death and taxes kind of belief. And not to be fudging around that. And he takes great joy that that is in fact what they've done. Look at verse 4. It's given me great joy to find that some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. See, what is the Father's command? Is to believe the Son and obey everything that he does, that he says, right? And so, to walk in that truth brings great joy. You know, he's speaking here of knowing that the church is kind of sticking to that, that the children are doing that. Like, it brings us joy within our own families when we see that happening, when we hear the prayers of the children, you know, when we see them living out that faith for themselves. And John is saying, for you as a church, as I see that happening, it brings great joy that that's true. And all he asks of them, verse five, is that they will continue in love. Dear lady, I'm not now writing you a new command, but one we've had from the beginning. That is, this is something that Jesus taught me, and now I'm just repeating it to you. I ask that we love one another. This is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you heard from the beginning, from Jesus, his command is that you walk in love. So people who have this truth will obey Jesus and will therefore love. So truth and love and truth come together. They're not traded off. If you're a person who's really passionate about the truth, then you have to be a person who's passionate about loving one another. You don't get to choose at that point. You can't get to say, well, I really, really believe the gospel. It's just that I hate the other people at church. No, if you believe the gospel and if you follow Jesus in his commands, then you've got to love one another. And at this point, I kind of need you not to be embarrassed, but to think, who is the person in this church that you find the most difficult to love? And you need to love them. Right? That's the command of Jesus. And don't go saying, well, I'm just more a doctrine kind of person. No, doctrine people are people who need to love. And nor can you say, well, I'm just a loving kind of person. I've never been worried about doctrine and, you know, getting hot under the collar about truth. He's saying these things come out of truth. If you don't believe the truth, you won't be able to love. You can't know love without truth or truth without love. And then he switches in verse 7 to change from talking about genuine Christians and their love for one another to talking then about false teachers or deceivers, as he has it. Verse 7, many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist, right? Antichrist sounds like the stuff from horror movies, right? The Antichrist is coming. The end of the world is here, and here is the Antichrist who's going to, I don't know, do all the things you see in a Dan Brown novel, right? But in the Bible, there's not one Antichrist. There's lots. John expects them to have Antichrist there in the church, right? Amongst the Christians, there will be people who go out from them who now deny the things that they should confess. People who no longer will accept that Jesus really came in the flesh. Friends, I've met Antichrists. I've had conversation with the Antichrist, right? Several Antichrists I've had conversations with about this very point. Okay, so it's not just an end of the world, one person thing. It's a person who stands and will not accept this truth about Jesus. Jesus warns the same thing. He says that many false teachers will come who will proclaim different Christ to you, will try and lead people astray. But don't be fooled. These people are here who are deceiving. And it's not even that they are described as teaching something different. It's that they, and I noticed this really for the first time preparing this week, that they do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. Right? That's a bit subtle, but do you get that? It's not that they stand up in a pulpit and say, Jesus did not come in the flesh. It's when they're put on the spot and they're needing to confess that he came in the flesh, they won't acknowledge it. It's more like the radio situation, you know, where someone's asked that. And in a church context, it's probably coming up because they do have some kind of creed, right? Here are the things that we believe. Let's say it together so that we know what it is. And we know that these creeds are around even as the scriptures are being written, you know, and you can see examples of them within the scriptures. And it seems like there's a line there which talks about how Jesus has come in the flesh, and at that point they're crossing their fingers or they're not saying that word out aloud. And why is it? Well, for the same kind of reasons people wouldn't today. That this sounds like something which is embarrassing, and there are ways to speak about Jesus that don't involve that. It would have sounded embarrassing and weird in the first century because, well, the idea that God would come in the flesh just sounded so weird to them. For us, after 2,000 years of Christianity, it may not sound quite as strange, but for them, it almost sounded ludicrous. It was much easier to talk about Jesus as a life-giving spirit, right, who comes to enlighten the world. You know, that would make for an attractive teaching. People would get their teeth into that, and it'd be true, and you could talk about Jesus in those kind of terms. But to have to talk about Jesus as one who's come in the flesh was going to cause problems. And it's not that people thought, how can we think of the most wicked, terrible, untrue thing about Jesus and teach it? It's that they thought, if we want people to be followers of Jesus, how can we talk about Jesus in ways that will be attractive to people? I know, let's ditch this he came in the flesh bit, right? And you still see it today, where people will find different bits about the Christian faith and they'll just go radio silent on that. Or they just won't confess these bits. They'll leave out the bits that they think will make it more palatable If only we don't have to talk about Jesus as Lord in this kind of way, then people will think it's better and it'll be easier to sell the message to the world. Right? And there's a big warning here that we're not to do that. For that stumbling block about Jesus coming in the flesh, obviously that was an issue between Jews and Christians. And in the first century, many Jews believed and many didn't. But the thing that divided many of them was this very issue. Later, as the gospel goes out into the Greek world against the philosophy of the age, that would be a big issue. As it comes out fifth, sixth, seventh century with Islam on the rise, this becomes an issue again. Did Jesus come in the flesh? He's only a prophet. He cannot be God in the flesh. That's blasphemous. You're talking about a mother in heaven now. You know, we can't have that. Later, Unitarians. Later, Jehovah's Witness. You know, all sorts of cults that have come since who've said at this point, when it comes to talking about in the flesh, virgin birth, bodily resurrection, we've got to just dial that back because it sounds so weird and strange. And people have left the Christian faith and started all kinds of strange new teachings over that. That pattern happens again and again. Even though the Bible is so clear that Jesus came in the flesh and that his flesh matters so much. You know, his broken body, his shed blood. It's the very heart of the Christian faith. This is not something on the edges. So John gives this warning because it's real. Look at verse 9. Anyone who runs ahead and doesn't continue in the teaching of Christ just does not have God. Right? That's pretty strong. Imagine calling up James Valentine and saying, James, you've got a problem. You said you're going to give Christians a clear go, and yet there's a couple of people there who have just run on from Jesus, who've run on from the Christian gospel, who are teaching something quite different. They do not have Jesus, and therefore they do not have God. They're lovely, they're charming, they're good radio talent. You know, I'd enjoy listening to them in all kinds of ways and different contexts, but if you want to hear what the message is about Christianity, you can't listen to these people because they're telling lies. They're saying these things don't matter, when the gospel says it matters more than anything. They're saying there's lots of different roads up the mountain. You just got to find your own kind of path up the mountain to God. And yet God seems to be saying that there's only one path, and it's the one that he came down to us with. And he came down in the flesh. And so people who stand there and don't want to acknowledge the virgin birth or the bodily resurrection or that Jesus came in the flesh, they're really saying, well, we've got a better way to the Father than through Jesus. And frankly, he didn't need to come because we can think of better ways, other ways, alternate ways. And while that may fit into the spirit of the age to say, hey, we're all post-truth, you know, we can find your own way to God, that's not the message that we get from the scriptures. Instead, we hear that left to our own devices, we'd all choose some different road or none, but none of them would lead us to the Father. The Father, who could not be known, makes himself known only in the person of his Son. The God who could not be seen makes himself seen in the person of Jesus. In flesh, he comes. And so that fleshiness of Jesus really, really matters. And people who want to dismiss it and say that it's a nothing have actually run on from Jesus and run away from God altogether. And the warning he has there is not to be caught up with it, but also not to support it. You see that there in verse 10. If anyone comes to you and doesn't bring this teaching, don't take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked work. Right? Now, a couple of caveats on this. This is not saying don't welcome anyone you've got a difference with, right? There will be churches that have different views on, I don't know, baptism or who should be ordained or what they should be called, or there've been different things like that matter, but that don't matter like this. This is something that matters a lot. You know, who Jesus is and what he's done. That's quite central to the faith. That's not to be messed around with. And he's saying people who have these different views aren't to be supported. When it says they're not to be welcomed into the house, I don't think it means you kind of have a doctrinal test before you invite people around for New Year's parties or, things like that. Instead, welcoming them into the house is the way that you would support people in their ministry in the first century, right? These traveling teachers would come in and they'd be supported. They'd be brought into a household, kind of freed up from needing to work in order to free them to speak that gospel message, right? So it's more like saying, don't have people like this on the ministry staff or, teaching the youth group or doing school scripture. When it comes to those kind of things, make sure that you test what people believe in terms of coming in the flesh. I have Jewish friends that I'd welcome into the house that we understand the difference that we have. The rabbis invited me to read Old Testament scriptures with him, and I'm probably going to be doing that this year. But we're honest with each other about the differences, and I'm not inviting him to join the staff here and to teach different things about Jesus, right? And to his credit, he's not inviting me onto the staff of his synagogue either, right? We understand that there's a difference there. We can be civil about the way that we speak about that difference. But you don't welcome into your house, you don't put onto the leadership of the church people who have these strange and variant beliefs about Jesus, because they'll lead all kinds of people astray and they'll kill a church. Churches aren't built on uncertainty and doubt, but on conviction of the truth and holding to that truth about Jesus. And then he gives what should be a memory verse for the digital age. I have much to write to you. I don't want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. See, there's a reality to the relationship there that goes beyond pen and ink, goes beyond, text messages. He wants to see them face to face to share the joy. Do you know that joy? You're part of a church, 9:30 at Grace, at Barney's, where people really genuinely love each other in the truth. If you're not, have we failed to understand the truth here that's being spoken of? See, if we understand that Jesus came into the flesh, the appropriate response is joy. To have hearts that are changed by that. To realize that he comes in the flesh out of love, at great cost, knowing that it will cost him his life in order to give us life. We who would be dead without him. I hope that makes you smile this year. I hope that brings you a joy and a contentment which is deeper than any of the circumstances that you might find that might buffet you around and knock you up and down, so that whatever 2017 looks like, it can be one of great joy, of great truth, of great love. It is the kind of date, isn't it, where we do make decisions about the kind of people we want to be, and the kind of things that we want to do and how it is we're going to live our lives. And I tell you, I didn't expect it, but this little book of 2 John has got so much for us in helping us shape ourselves individually and in households and in churches to be the kind of people that God would have us be. In the moment of crisis and confusion of the early church, where there were different voices pulling them this way or that, when they were being asked to hold on to a teaching which sounded strange to the ears of all those people around, it must have been hard to stick to the truth. And friends, we'll feel that pressure still today. In a post-truth world, it's very tempting to ditch the things which are going to sound at odds with the world around. It's going to be very easy to want to run ahead with people who seem more progressive than others. And yet real truth, real love, and real joy is found in understanding that Jesus Christ came into the world in flesh. Amen.